It's an honour to be here, especially on Melbourne Day, and I will say something towards the end of this lecture about what sort of place Melbourne was in the 1860s, 70s and 80s, which are the periods that which I know very well now from being in charge of the Argus Index project. The project began because there's no continuous index to a decent metropolitan Australian newspaper. So researchers in Australia do not have the advantages of the researchers in the UK or the US, who can consult a continuous index to the Times and to the New York Times, which can be the starting point for research on any topic whatsoever. There are indexes to the Argus from its starting point in 1846 until 1859. These were done by J.A. Feely, a former state librarian here. The Argus itself then issued its own index from 1910 to 1949. It was often described as the Times of Australia, and now it was doing what the Times did, issuing its own index. In 1983, which you people would know was the 150th anniversary, or just before the 150th anniversary of this state, the celebrations included a History and Heritage Committee, whose brief was not to reenact Batman's meeting with the Aborigines, which is what might have been done before, but to fund projects with enduring value and make history accessible to the people. And Marion Aveling, a historian from Monash, suggested that one of the things we should at least start doing was indexing the Argus Gap, the period for which there was no index. And Marion had the very good idea. I think committees work very well like this. She just put one person from the committee in charge of each project. So I became the Argus person. And then I created a little committee at the La Trobe Library to run it, to oversee it. The Argus Gap is a bit of a misnomer. There are 14 years done by Feely. The Argus did 40 years. The gap is 50 years. It's more like a yawning chasm than a gap. It's been a very long project to fill it, but we now have indexes for the 1860s, the 1870s, the 1880s. The 1890s have been read, and the indexing is beginning. This has all been done on a shoestring compared with some major projects. Volunteers read the paper in the first instance and record contents very, very briefly and succinctly, following our guide. And I'm very pleased that there are some of the volunteers here tonight, and Diana Phoenix, who took charge of the volunteers, helped them understand the rules, looked over their work. She is here too. She's been a great force in the project. There's only one paid person in the project, and that is our chief indexer, Geraldine Souter, who can't be here this evening. She has done a wonderful job. The first year she did, the 1860, was 1860 itself, won the Australian Indexers a prize for the best index of that year. You'll see examples of her work in a minute. And later I'll tell you where you can access this marvellous index. We chose the Argus because some indexing had already been done, but the other reason is that it's a quality newspaper, a paper of record, not as popular as The Age, which was cheaper, and the Radical paper in the 19th century. But the Argus was larger physically, it carried more news. And in those days, the distinction between editorial and news was much, much stricter than it is today. So the politics of the Argus don't intrude very much on its news gathering. I've called it a paper of record, and since we no longer have papers of record, I better explain what that means. Many of you will have looked at old papers and know what I mean. If the Premier is launching an election campaign, his full speech will be reproduced. Not just the highlights, not just queries about why he's saying this when previously he said that, not comments by other people about what he said. The whole speech is given. There might be an editorial on it, but there's no Michel Grattan. They preferred the speech to the commentary. It's complete in another sense. The Argus and other newspapers of that sort record the whole life of the town, recording events even if they're only routine, which is so very different from our experience reading even the quality newspapers today. Because what we get is what is unusual or bizarre or outrageous, what is out of the ordinary, that's what makes news. And at breakfast, when I'm reading quality newspapers, The Age or The Australian, I'm often outraged at what I read. Then I complain to my wife, who complains it's no use complaining to her. Why don't I write something? And I used to write quite a lot, but I'm sort of coming to the end of my career, and I think, well, the world will have to learn how to get used to coping without me, so I don't write quite as much as I used to. But you can imagine how much more calming breakfast would be if you read an item like this in the newspaper. This is from the Argus of February 1862. The adjourned annual meeting of the Melbourne Philharmonic Society was held last evening in the Mechanics Institute Hall, Mr. Sumner in the chair. The minutes of the annual meeting having been read and confirmed, Mr. Rutter brought up the report of the special committee appointed at the former meeting to revise the rules and constitution of the society. And the rules were gone through seriatim, the great majority of them being merely verbally amended. In others, a few alterations of no general interest were made. The meeting then adjourned at a late hour till Tuesday next, when the election of officers will take place. The attendance was numerous. How calming that is. How routine. When I looked at that again, I thought, is there an Argus reporter there for that very long meeting? And then I thought, perhaps they provided their own report to the Argus, but would they say a few alterations of no general interest? You know, it sounds like someone a bit outside. With reports like that, coming regularly, coming routinely, you could follow the doings of the University Council, the Hospital Board, the Port Authority, the Acclimatisation Society, which did a great amount of work, was a very popular body, ran the zoo, the Royal Society. If this had been 1862, there would have been a reporter from the Argus here to report what I was saying. Any meeting where someone gave a lecture or a talk in the city was reported. Crime sold then, as it does now, but crime was also treated routinely. Every day, the police court would begin with the names of the drunks. And we had to decide, were we going to include them? It's just a list, 10 names. And we decided, no, unless the report is 3, 4, or 5 lines, we won't include it. But those reports are trifling crimes compared with what crime has to be to get in papers today. A man steals a bottle of wine from a pub, and that's recorded. We've recorded it. Papers of record, of course, are a godsend to historians, and that's the reason why we've spent so much time. This is an anti-PowerPoint lecture, and instead of showing you somewhere what we've done, you can look at it. These are random pages. You can take 2 or 3. Well, you will notice that the index is not just giving you a list of references. It's describing pretty well every item with a line and a bit. These are all from 1884. I've just given them out randomly. It's an American style of giving the reference. It's the year first, 84, 07 means July 1884, then the day of the month, 21st, then the page number, then the column number. So we've given ourselves a great test of accuracy. Can we be accurate to this level? And I reckon we're accurate about 99% of the time. There is a bit of a difficulty because sometimes there were early and late editions of the Argus. Has anyone got any questions just on what you're looking at? It doesn't make sense. Or
the number reference, how do you understand that?
First is the year. It's 84, isn't it? It's 84.
Yeah,
8404 is April.
Yeah.
And then the last is the day of the month.
Yeah.
Then the page. Then the column. A, B, C, D is the column. We've always struggled to get funding for this project, and we need it to keep Geraldine working. Now we have a new difficulty in attracting funding because the Argus itself is now online and you can search it by word, and lots of people say, well, since you can search it by word, what need is there for an index? And I'm going to take some little time to explain why there is still a great advantage in having an index. For some things, of course, word works well. Graham Davison, the great urban historian, was telling me recently he just put sprawling as a word search. He wanted to find the moment when urban sprawl or suburban sprawl entered the language. Now, for that sort of exercise, it's a wonderful facility. But for other things, you need to know a lot more than a word. You have to know the right words to enter for a 19th century world. For instance, if you search under child abuse, you'll get nothing. If you search under child, of course, you'll get millions of hits. Because in the 19th century, that's not the term people used. They referred to child cruelty, child desertion, child assault, child neglect. We gather all those together. Some of them appear under child abuse, and then we have cross-references to child neglect or child desertion. If you type in rape, you'll get a few references, but not very many, or not a high proportion of the total, because rape is often described in this way, as a capital offence, an outrage, an attempted violation, a criminal assault, or an indecent assault. Partly this is through delicacy, I think, in dealing with sexual matters and violent sexual encounters. And, of course, we know the Victorians had a strong taboo about that. Some of our taboos, just in their defence, they didn't share. Suicide and death are recorded far more regularly and in a lot more detail than appear in our papers now. As various people have said, their taboo was sex, our taboo is death. So you get plenty on death. It's partly through delicacy, and partly, you might have picked up on this already, rape was a capital offence. You were hanged. If you were convicted, you would be hanged. Now, very few people were. The sentence was commuted. But because of that, the charge often wasn't made rape. In order to get a jury to convict, you called it something else. You called it criminal assault or attempted violation. And we've had to take a bit of a punt sometimes, and we've said most of that is what we would call rape. In 1862, we have 40 entries under rape, and only six of them actually use that word. The paper only used that word in six of the cases. We've spent a lot of time correcting the newspaper men who would often give different spellings for the same name. So we've tried to gather together all the entries that relate to a particular person, all the entries that relate to a particular trade union, even if sometimes it's called the Amalgamated Carpenters and sometimes just the Carpenters, or other times Carpenters and Joiners. We've tried to work that out. We haven't always succeeded. It is a very good name index as well as a very good subject index. In many cases, of course, their words are our words. If you type in railways, you'll get plenty of entries on railways. If you are interested in railways in the 1880s, you'll get thousands, tens of thousands. If there were no indexes, you might begin to order all these entries. If you were interested in looking at railways throughout the 1880s, and you might first of all say, oh, well, I'll do it by area. We'll do Gippsland railways, I'll group them together, then I'll do the railway to Albury and the North East, I'll do Western District, I'll do up to Echuca, I'll go out to the North West, then I'll separate out the administration of the railways, then I'll separate out arguments over what the railways charged for freight, then I'll put accidents in a separate heap, there's a huge number of them, arguments about Sunday trains, which was a huge issue, arguments about excursion tickets. Well, we've done all that. So the first sifting that any researcher would have to do, we've done. It's all there. You can run your eye over 10 pages of the railways and find, you know, just where you want to concentrate. If you're interested in elections, we've done a lot of preliminary work. You need to know the names of the electorates, which aren't the names of the electorates now, and they don't always relate in any obvious way to the districts that they cover. So when we treat a general election, we have the 100 or so electorates and all the meetings and activities grouped under the electorates, which is a huge labour, and it saves any researcher a huge amount of time. If you're interested in hotels in Melbourne, we've organised all the entries under the names of the particular hotels, so you can see very quickly which hotels were regularly before the court for selling adulterated drinks or having prostitutes on the premises or being open after hours. And if you run your eye down them, two hotels always stand out, Scott's and Young and Jackson's, because they were places where people met. They were meeting places as well as pubs. Scott's was for the elite. So here you get stock exchange dinners, dinners for entertaining a visiting premier, meetings of the sheep breeders. This is something that you would query when you first saw it. Meeting of the electors for Murray and Balranald electorates. These are New South Wales electorates. And what these is are the squatters, the absentee squatters from the Riverina, who live in Melbourne or nearby. They meet together at Scott's Hotel, debate which candidates they'll support, then presumably send messages back to their overseers and managers to say who they want to see elected. And on one occasion, I was checking this this week, they hired a special train and 50 of them went up to Echuca so they could vote in the election, which is a little indication of Melbourne's hold on the Riverina. Young Jackson's, by contrast, was the sporting men's pub. Meetings over football, rowing, cricketing, tennis. You can see why when Chloe was thrown out of the public library, or the public library and art gallery, it found a home at Young and Jackson's. It was the young men about town's pub. The index is also useful for finding out things you don't know about. Rumsfeld, the previous vice president in America, made this term famous. Do you remember? The unknown unknowns. There are many things we don't know, we can find out, but there are lots of things we don't know we don't know. There used to be advice to historians that you should exhaust the sources before you start writing. Well, of course, in most cases, that's impossible. Someone told me once, or I read it, that an alternative to that is, if you're doing a span of years, to read one source throughout the whole span of years. And that's a sort of check to make sure that you're just not going in at these three places and something very interesting on your topic happened in between them. No other books might have mentioned them, but you'll find it if you do this check. And I did it when I started my work on convict New South Wales. I followed this advice. I got Wentworth's paper, The Australian, started in 1824, and I read it every bit of it for about 20 years. And that was fairly easy to do. It only came out a couple of times a week and it was tiny. But reading it was my way into New South Wales, not through reading and thinking about what other people had read about New South Wales, but getting closer to the action. When I read the court cases, when people were bringing convicts to court for not working or running away or being drunk, that's when I got a handle on that issue and abandoned my notion that convicts were being flogged because masters were being cruel. Convicts were being flogged because they didn't want to work, or they wanted to get drunk, or they wanted to run away. There's lots of that. And I got a sense of that just from reading the papers. Well, you couldn't read the Argus. Well, you could, but it would take you a long time to read all the Argus, say, for the 1880s. But you could sit down and in a day read or turn every page of our Argus Index. And that's a way of getting a hold on, you know, what was pertinent at the time. What were the issues of the moment? What was political debate like? And historians, of course, always choose their themes. But if you go on reading them, you'll find that lots of things they're not talking about. Issues that were huge at the moment, because of our preoccupations and the lines we draw through our history, somehow fall away. But when you read it, you know, you take excursion trains and Sunday trading far more seriously. If you're just reading the history books, where it seems a bit of an oddity. And even very good historians like Jeff Searle, it's hard to catch Jeff Searle out, whose books are just almost encyclopedic. They don't read like that, of course, very beautifully written. But I did catch him out. In the 1880s, the Central Board of Health is established. And it's very aggressively going around to all the theatres and to the churches and telling them they have to reorganise their unsafe places. You might say it's a minor issue. But it was a big issue in the 1880s. When I read the Argus, because I'm the last person to read the index before it's printed up or goes online as a sort of final check. So I've read it all. And I found things in the index that I didn't know about. There was an anti-transportation movement in Victoria in the 1860s. I don't know if any of you knew about this. I didn't know. If I'd been asked, I said the anti-transportation movement finished in 1853 when convicts stopped going to Tasmania. But this was a movement to stop the British government sending convicts to Western Australia. And it was a very large movement. In 1864, there are four pages of entries, like you've seen what a page of entry looks like now. Public meetings, petitions, resolutions by local councils, intercolonial conferences, government involvement, formation of an anti-transport league. I've always said that this index is so good you can write your history from it. You don't have to bother about the papers itself. And on one occasion, I've done that myself. And this is the first time this is being revealed publicly. This is the sentence I wrote. This is in my book on Federation. And I was very interested in what interconnections there were before there was a federal movement. And this, of course, is Victoria reshaping Australia to be convict-free. Western Australia was an affront to their sense of what Australia was to become. Some of the convicts from Western Australia moved east when their time was up. This was a minor annoyance. But the very presence of convicts in the West was a reproach to the East. It kept alive the association of Australia with convictism, which the Eastern colonists were desperate to put behind them. In the 1860s, they mounted a strong campaign led from Melbourne, chiefly, and Victoria, to persuade Britain to abolish transportation. The Argus in Melbourne sent a reporter to the West to do an expose on the convict system and the degradation it brought. When the colonial governments threatened to stop subsidising the mail steamer that called at Albany, the British government gave way and transportation ended in 1868. Well, it's just a workmanlike paragraph, isn't it? I could do it because those entries are so full. And when I went back to check them this week, I found I missed out. I should have put it there. The idea is there. Edward Wilson, who was one of the proprietors of the Argus and who made a lot of money out of it, and left it to a charitable trust, which thankfully supports the creation of this project, the Argus Index. Edward Wilson had this wonderful idea. It's an Australian fantasy. He said, all right, if they're going to continue transportation, let's create a fund, and he put up £100 to start it, so that any expired convict who wants to go back to Britain can go back at our expense. So we will retransport the convicts back to Britain, see how they like it then. But he didn't have to do it, because this other move, public opinion, and the real thing was the threat to not subsidise the mail steamers, if they called it Western Australia. That's what made Britain bend finally. I learnt from the index that Victorians started a new colony in Western Australia in the 1860s. I never knew this before. It was at Camden Harbour, which is way up in the Kimberley, almost into the Northern Territory. It was a disaster. You can follow its fortunes in the index. There's one entry which says 100 persons with 5,000 sheep and 30 horses and 100 dogs and stores for 12 months leave for Camden Harbour. And about 5 or 6 months later, settlers return to Victoria due to sheep dying and no income. It was a complete disaster. I was in the tropics. They had no idea of coping with the wet, and Camden Harbour's a nice harbour, but the interior was a disaster. This was semi-official. The governor had encouraged this. He wanted the governor of West Australia had encouraged this. He wanted white settlement to spread to the north, so he sent up a resident magistrate or something. But the settlers was a creation. Settlers movement was a creation of the Victorians. Someone in West Australia has written a book about it. You know, it's of interest to them. I hadn't heard of it before. One of the joys and temptations of reading newspapers when you're just turning pages rather than using an index or looking for words is you pick up, the interesting little tidbits, the things on the side, the things that the Age might put in odd spot now on the front page. Well, this is such a good index that those sort of things survive. Man trying to kill snake strikes gold at Inglewood. A man was found by police to have several copies of the temperance magazine Band of Hope Review on his person. He was charged with stealing them, but the case was dismissed because no owner for them could be found. Here's another temperance thing. A man charged with attempted murder of his housekeeper got off after he married the housekeeper and signed the pledge. The case came to Higginbotham and he said, though you've now married this girl, he was still charged with murder. He said, though you've married your housekeeper, you weren't married when you tried to kill her, so she can give evidence against you. And she gave very hesitant evidence. Higginbotham summed up for a conviction, but the jury dismissed the case, let him off. And I got to that through just looking at the index. The index gives abundant evidence of Melbourne as a dynamic place, not just the capital of Victoria, but with interests and concerns way beyond it. Tuppeny picked this up in Town Life in Australia, published in the 1880s. If there is a company to be got up to stock the wilds of Western Australia, or to form a railway on the land grant system in Queensland, to introduce the electric light, or to spread education among the black fellows, the promoters either belong to Melbourne or go there for their capital. Now, the index provides ample evidence for that, but wider than Tuppeny indicated there. Great interest in the Pacific Islands, both for trade and for missionary endeavour. Here are two adjacent entries under Fiji in 1868. The Reverend Thomas Barker murdered in Fiji, first missionary martyr of Australian Wesleyan Church. Project to form Fiji Banking and Trading Company. And then a few entries later, King Thakombar repudiates treaty with Fiji Banking and Trading Company. There was much about the Pacific, much about New Zealand. Jeff Searle, when he launched our first little volume on the 1860s, said, isn't it interesting, the entry on New Zealand was longer than the entry on New South Wales. The entries for other colonies depend on some connection with Victoria, so internal New Zealand affairs don't get indexed. But all the connections between New Zealand and Victoria do get indexed. Another impression is how quickly things get done. A company decides to build the cable trams, and it seems in not much more than 12 months all the objectors to the building of the cable trams have been put down or ignored, and the cars are running. The great new movement in the country in the 1890s was irrigation. And in the twinkling of an eye, it seems, you know, the local irrigation trusts are formed, the canals and waterways are built, and the thing is up and running. Now, of course, we would have had environmental impact statements and cost-benefit analysis. And now, you know, Deakin is always hailed as the great hero of irrigation. But now I've read the criticisms of the irrigation movement in Victoria in the 1880s, which run to this effect, that the environment, the density of settlement and the productivity of the land was really not sufficient to warrant the expense of bringing all that water. So in the long term, perhaps they may a mistake there. But sometimes I feel sort of things have got out of our hands. If we want to do something, someone finds a special frog that's going to get in its way. And I think, God, you know, I'll have a freeway before a frog. What's what we do eventually, of course, but it takes a long time. They must have had the sense of things happening quickly. You have an idea, you raise some money, you do it, which is a very different environment from what we live in today. Law was much something that moved much more rapidly. Shakespeare wrote of the law's delay, put those words in Hamlet's mouth, and some matters, probably on the civil side, were drawn out and delayed. But serious crime cases come up very quickly. Today, serious crime is being tried 2 years after the offence, and witnesses are being asked to give evidence. You know, where was this person staying? 2 years have passed. Just seems crazy. In Victoria, if it's two or three months, it's a long time. It's often, you know, only the next month or the one after that serious crime gets to the criminal court. Ned Kelly was captured late in June, and the trial was late October, and that was a long period, partly because Ned had to be nursed back to health before he could be tried and hanged. Coroner's inquests happened almost immediately. They happened on view of the body. The practice was the body was put in a public place nearest to where it expired. Might be a pub or a hall or a police station. And a jury is convened. They're still using the old English practice of a jury. So within 2 days of a suspicious death, a jury, under guidance from the coroner, is giving a verdict, and if the verdict is that there's been foul play, that is immediately put into action. I think I'm already getting close to running out of time. There are things that I can talk about in question time on the scope. We don't index everything, and you might be interested in what's in and what's out. I should say, in regard to accessible, which was one of our briefs, we wanted this index to be good for researchers but also for the amateur historian or the occasional researcher. So quite unusually, we've got a very strong focus on place. The Argus Index itself does subject and not place. So if you want to know what the Paraim Council did on something, you have to look under municipal. If you look under Paraim, there's nothing. And if you didn't know how they'd organised it, you would think, oh, I've drawn a blank. But we have a long entry under Paraim, which will have the Paraim Council. It will have all the local doings of the churches. The churches, as colony-wide or Australian-wide bodies, are indexed under their denominational name. But all the local church news is indexed under place. Fires are indexed under place. Bushfires are indexed under place. And they're very useful for a whole range of... Fires often give you a description not only of the building that was on fire, but the neighbouring buildings as well. You get a sense of how people are living. You know, it was a three-room shack and there were 10 people living in it. You get that sort of information. You also get it from inquests as well, which is a wonderful source, and which, by the way, we don't index, because on the principle that if there's a good collection of sources with a good guide to them elsewhere, we didn't bother. That is, we don't do parliamentary debates. I mean, that seems silly. There's a fuller record in the parliamentary debates themselves with very good indexes. I should speak finally about where you can get to look at this index if you haven't looked at it before. We produced the 1860s in hard copy and sold it to libraries around the country. There's a copy at the State Library, some local libraries in Melbourne, all the major libraries in Australia bought copies. In order to get bigger dollops of money, we were persuaded that we should move to putting the index online and getting the Australian Research Council to support it under their infrastructure terms. That is, this is a resource which is of great benefit to researchers. So, for a long time, the Australian Research Council did fund us, and that was a big project. It involved a number of universities, and the National Library signed up to be the host of the website. And so the first decade we put on the website was the 1870s, and until very recently that was there, and that was a wonderful site. You can browse the index in the way I've talked about it. You can treat it just as a book and turn the pages if you want to get the feel of something, but you can also index across the decade by subject and by word. And so it was beautifully presented, a very flexible resource. But then sadly, when we sent up the 1880s to join the 1870s, at that point the library said, sorry, we're changing our IT, the usual story. You know, we're upgrading and our new system won't accommodate what we've created for your special site. And we fought that decision, and we had support from Andrew Lemon and I think some of your council here. It was very disappointing, and it shows how insecure online material is. You know, it's a wonderful resource, but if the IT people get in the heads of the managers and say it's costing too much or it's incompatible, it can just disappear, which is what houses done. It's off. It's not on the National Library site anymore. The National Library said we'll help transfer it to La Trobe University's library research site at our library. But that will only be in PDF form for each year, so you won't be able to search readily across the year. But Geraldine says with some search engines you'll be able to do that. It came back in very shoddy form, I must say. So we're still having a battle with the National Library to get them to improve what they've sent us. And if that battle goes sour, we'll be looking for support on that again. But one good thing has come out of this process. that the people who did this rearranging found a way so that you can go on, you click on to the index entry, and that takes you immediately to the newspaper itself, which is online. And which is what people now expect to do. You know, people no longer expect or are prepared to copy down or Xerox a succession of entries and then go and bring up via Trove the Argus itself. This is automatic. You click on and there's the paper, there's the column, there's our article. And if we can get that working, it will be a wonderful resource. I'm disappointed in a way in librarians. They haven't lived up to their fusty image, you know, they're gung-ho for new technology. They're moving the books out. They're even destroying books. So I'm not sure that my strategy, if we put the Argus Index in books, that will make it secure. I hope it does. My colleague at La Trobe, Richard Broom, says, Hurst, you've written some fine books. But he said in 100 years no one will be reading them. But they will still be using the Argus Index. So that's my claim to immortality. Many people have helped us in this project with money and support. Andrew Lemon, when he was running the Friends of the La Trobe Library, helped us to launder money through the Friends to help pay for Geraldine. And as I've said, sometimes the Royals put money in and gave us support earlier this year, and for that I'm very grateful. Thank you.